Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 23 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Maleen. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 23. With a crash, the hypnotist dropped unconscious to the floor as the hypnotic machine started to revolve rapidly. The emissaries turned from Locke and were dazzled by the blinding flashes from the whirling mirrors. It was Zita who caused all the commotion. Unnoticed by the thugs, who were intent on sending Locke to his death and dragging Eva through the panel, Zita had managed to free herself from her bonds, and true to her promise to Locke that she would help him, she had risked all for his sake. Once free from the ropes, she had seized a heavy bronze vase, and at just the critical moment of danger had hurled it at the hypnotist's head, striking him a terrific blow that had felled him and left him unconscious on the floor before he could spring the trap. She had then set the mechanical hypnotic machine in motion, and standing behind it was herself practically invisible. It all happened so quickly that it seemed like a miracle. Locke, his hope revived, swiftly grasped the one chance for life that was left to him. By contracting his muscles, he was able to slip out of the ropes which bound his arms. But since the noosed rope around his neck held him so that his toes barely touched the floor of the trap, he could not, try as he might, manage to get the noose free. Suddenly, a plan flashed across his mind. Hanging from the ceiling a few feet in front of him, he could see an enormous chandelier. Throwing his hands above his head, he grasped the rope, thus relieving the strain on his neck. Then, snapping his body backward, his feet came in contact with the wall. With tremendous force, he kicked out, causing his body to swing in an arc toward the chandelier. It was not until he had wrapped his legs about the branches of the chandelier that the emissaries noticed what he was doing, so fascinated were they by the revolving mirrors. Even then they could scarcely resist the auto-hypnotic powers of the contrivance. Finally, however, with a shout, they came to the attack. Locke was now hanging head downward. With one hand he succeeded in loosening the noose from about his neck, while with the other he struck out, hitting an emissary a fearful swinging blow that sent the fellow staggering backward to fall against the lever controlling the trap door. With a crash the trap was sprung, with the pit yawning beneath it. Struggling, striking, grappling with his assailants, Locke managed to hurl three of them to their deaths in the underground river below. Horror-stricken at the fate of their companions, the other emissaries stepped back when, to add to their confusion, Zita, with remarkable strength for so frail a girl, lifted the stand of mirrors and hurled it among them. Locke somersaulted to the floor, and seizing the broken stand, used it as a weapon with deadly effect. The emissaries turned and fled. An instant later, Locke started to the panel through which Eva had been dragged, when he heard steps from the other side. It was the emissaries who had seized Eva, coming back to see what all the rumpus was about. Locke, forewarned, slipped close to the wall, and as they passed through the panel, one at a time, he was able to fell them to the floor. Then he rushed through the panel just in time to see Eva, pursued by the automaton, running toward him. The very strangeness of her terrible adventure had brought Eva out of the hypnotic state into which she had been thrown, and she clung to Locke as though she were a child. Locke took her in his arms, and swiftly evading the slow-moving monster, dashed back to the hypnotic room, calling to Zita to run to the street. Thus all three were able to make good their escape. Eva had purposely left her motor turning over, and therefore it was barely an instant after they were in the street before they were streaking out of that quarter of the town. Zita was now overwhelmed by her feelings, but it was Eva herself who spoke first. "Forgive me, Zita," begged Eva, in the rush of her emotions, forgetting all that Zita had done. "But for you, both of us would now be dead." For some moments Zita could not reply in her silent sadness at seeing the joy of Locke with his girl.
"I forgive you?" she murmured at length. "It is for you to forgive me."
She paused a moment and choked back a sob, then added bravely,
I can even wish for your happiness, my dear. My hope is dead."
Only Locke understood, and as he watched Zita, he resolved to do all he could for her, realizing that someone else had made her a victim of her love and jealousy. All breathed a sigh of relief when at last they came again in sight of the lights of Brent Rock. There was just the trace of a shadow to cloud the momentary happiness at their safe arrival, as on the steps Zita refused to enter.
"I must say good-bye,"
she murmured, wistfully, turning to go into the night alone. Nothing that either Locke or Eva could say seemed to swerve her purpose.
"Can't you see?" she exclaimed finally, turning to Locke. "Balcom, Paul, and Dr. Q all trust me now. I can help you solve the mystery better if I leave the house."
This was so evident that Locke and Eva were forced to consent. They took her back to the city, leaving her where she could be unobserved, then returned in a very hopeful mood again to Brent Rock.
"I think she can and will help us," declared Eva intuitively.
"Yes," agreed Locke slowly. "And if Zita finds the record of her birth, I believe we shall solve the mystery." Worn out with the terrors through which she had passed, Eva bade Locke an affectionate good night and went to her room, while he went to the laboratory and tried again to find an antidote for the Madagascar madness, a work that kept him up late and to which he returned again early the following morning. It was on that following day, in the River Road apartment of Deluxe Dora, that Paul and she were having a demi-monde lover's quarrel. Paul was intoxicated, and Dora may have been angry about that, or it may have been that she was jealous of some other woman. However, they were quarreling fiercely when there came a knock at the door.
"You open it,"
flashed Dora to Paul. He demurred a moment, then, changing his mind, consented and crossed to the door, while Dora ran to her own room and hid. Paul was very much surprised to find that the visitor was Zita, much excited.
"I want you to help me on something of great importance," she exclaimed,
almost before she had entered. "Why, certainly. Anything you desire," hiccuped Paul. "Come on in."
Zita entered the apartment and they crossed over to the chaise lounge, where Zita made her direct plea.
"Help me find the record of my birth," she begged.
Paul pulled his wandering wits together and thought a moment. Then a particularly crafty look came into his eyes as he detached a key from his key ring.
"Here, take this," he directed. "It's the key to my father's apartment. The records you want are there. He and I have quarreled, and you can go as far as you like."
Zita took the key eagerly, thanked Paul profusely, and started for the door. She had barely passed the threshold before Dora, who had heard all, was at the telephone in her own room and was angrily calling up Balcom at his apartment. Balcom, assisted by his Madagascar servant, was at the moment packing a trunk, perhaps preparatory to a hasty flight, should that become necessary. The moment the telephone rang, he picked up the receiver and nearly choked with anger as he heard Dora's whispered voice over the wire.
"Paul has given Zita the key to your apartment," Dora hastened, "and she is coming over to steal the record of her birth."
"She is, eh? Well, I'll take care of that," growled Balcom as he rang off.
Balcom went to a drawer in the table and from it took a large book. Rapidly he turned over the pages until he found what he wanted. Then he made an erasure and an entry and replaced the book in the drawer. Next he called the servant.
"When she comes, you make her a prisoner," he directed. "Understand?"
The Madagascan nodded and raised one of Balcom's hands to his own forehead as a sign of his fidelity. Balcom went out, and the servant stepped into the empty trunk to await the arrival of Zita. But it was a very different person with whom the Madagascan had to contend in the end. On leaving Dora's apartment, Zita telephoned Brent Rock, and Locke answered immediately. Locke readily agreed to make the search of Balcom's apartment in Zita's stead. When the Madagascan heard a key in the door, he stealthily peeped from his hiding place and saw, instead of Zita, Locke. Locke's back was turned, and the Madagascan, undaunted, sprang from the trunk and leaped, cat-like, on Locke's back. But he had not reckoned on his antagonist. Locke, always on guard, was not taken quite by surprise. He caught the savage in a jiu-jitsu hold, throwing him over his head to land in a far corner of the room. In spite of the fall, the Madagascan bounded to his feet like a rubber ball, but a few stiff jabs from Locke soon took all the fight out of him, and he lay still, completely knocked out. Locke made a hurried but systematic search of the room, and finally found the book that he sought, taking it and returning to Eva at Brent Rock. After telephoning, Zita went directly to Dr. Q's laboratory, to which she was admitted after he had seen her through his periscope annunciator. The doctor was fumbling with a test tube, from which some heavy fumes were issuing. He motioned her to a chair, near a table upon which were many papers which looked to Zita as though they might be of importance. Always quick to act, Zita raised her hand as if to arrange her hair, and as she did so, she purposely knocked the test tube out of the doctor's hand. The acid spattered on some of the papers, quickly setting them afire. Dr. Q, wildly excited, started to beat out the flames, and in so doing allowed several unseared letters to flutter to the floor. One in particular arrested Zita's attention. It was a drawing, a plan of some sort, and was marked
plan of den. Zita placed her foot on it, and while Dr. Q was engaged with the small blaze, she reached down, and hastily folding it, thrust it into one of the low shoes she was wearing. Then she went to Dr. Q's assistance, and in a jiffy the fire was out. The doctor was furiously angry at her, and feeling that she had accomplished all that she might expect, she expressed her regrets for the accident, and went out before his anger became any worse. Thus it was that Zita arrived at Brent Rock only a few moments after Locke, whom she found in the library with Eva, turning over the pages of the record he had secured at Balcom's. The record purported to be a record of marriages of Wallace County, New York, and Locke finally found an entry that read, "Peter Brent and Rita Dane." For a moment Zita was stunned. It was her mother's name. Locke smiled. "Yes, Zita," he said quietly. "For a moment Eva and I were surprised, too. But it's a palpable forgery. Balcom has tried to prove that you and Eva are half-sisters. But look!" He handed her a powerful magnifying glass, and through it the clumsy forgery stood out in all its crudeness, showing plainly where other names had been erased and these inserted. Zita was greatly disappointed, for she had thought that at last she would establish her identity. Then she remembered the paper she had hidden in her shoe. She slipped the paper out and handed it to Locke, who was greatly excited over its importance. They were still studying it when Locke heard a strange noise, as of shuffling feet, in the hallway. He jumped to the door, and there, in the dim light of the stairway leading down to the Graveyard of Genius, he saw a knot of men carrying another man, who was evidently helpless. Locke started forward, but they were gone. Eva hurried upstairs to her father's room, fearing something was wrong. "Father's gone!" she cried despairingly. Locke threw himself full against the door at the head of the cellar stairs which the men had slammed shut. He tried to batter it down, but it was too strongly built. Then he drew his revolver, and with the barrel started to push out the pins from the hinges. He worked feverishly, and succeeded in driving the top pin out. Then, using it as a lever, he was able to pull the door from its frame. He dashed down the stairs, but was late by only the fraction of a second, as a metal hand was just closing the huge door to the Graveyard of Genius. He fumbled at the secret combination, and as he was doing so, Eva and Zita joined him. The door swung open, and they rushed through. But the place was deserted. "They've carried your father through some secret passage," exclaimed Locke. "That would explain much that is strange that has happened about the house, too." Just then Zita stepped forward with the plan in her hand. "See," she cried, "there is a secret passage marked on this." Locke studied the plan for some time, but whoever had drawn it had carefully concealed both the exact location of the passage and the method by which it was reached. As he searched, however, an idea occurred to Locke. "I'll rig a trap with a camera," he decided finally. A few minutes later he returned to the room with his special quick-shutter camera, a flash bag, and a ball of light twine. Carefully he focused the camera on the wall where the plan showed the secret passage to be. Then he rigged up the flash bag and connected the hole with the twine, which he strung all about the Graveyard of Genius, so that should any part of the wall move it would cause the twine to break, which in turn would at the same time release the shutter of the camera and explode the powder of the flashlight. Thus, without any direct human agency, a photograph would be taken. Next, he attached wires and ran them to the library above, where he installed an annunciator, the needle of which would indicate when the trap was sprung and the picture taken. Fascinated, the two girls watched. Eva was almost fainting with grief at the terrible fate that had overtaken her father. Even in his sickness, at least she had had him. But now he was gone. To what, she could only guess. Locke tried to console her as they paced the library above, even though he realized that such consolation was hollow. It was perhaps half an hour later when suddenly the needle of the annunciator began to vibrate rapidly. All leaped to their feet and ran down the stairs to the graveyard. At once Locke rushed to the camera, put in a slide, and took out the plate holder. Then they hurried up to his laboratory. There Locke procured a developing bag and started to work. Nervously and impatiently, Eva and Zita watched him at his task. At last the negative was ready, and Locke drew it from the bag and held it to the light. There, glaring out of the plate, was the devilish face of Balcom. Eva and Zita both uttered a cry of astonishment and consternation. Even Locke was amazed. But the strongest feeling he had was anger, as he turned to them. "You two take this plan," he exclaimed. "It shows a den with an exit indicated. Get someone to go with you. Find the place and wait for me there. I can find the secret entrance from the graveyard from this negative, and I'm going through it." Balcom, in the passageway between the Graveyard of Genius and the automaton's den, was livid with fury. He realized that his picture had been taken, surmised that the secret passage would be found, and that some assault on the den would be attempted. But he had had no time to locate the camera, which Locke had hidden well, nor had he dared to search longer for it when he heard Locke bounding down the stairs from the library. Accordingly, he had retreated and hastened back through the passageway into the automaton's den. "Quick!" he shouted to the horde of emissaries in the place. "Bring dynamite, electric wires, and a rack bar. They think they have us trapped. But if they try to follow me here, I tell you it'll mean certain death to them." The emissaries hastened to obey him. They brought the explosive and the means to detonate it, and carried the stuff into the passageway, where they made the connections. An emissary stepped forward and volunteered to use the rack bar when the time came, but Balcom waved him away. "No," he growled, "no one can take my revenge from me. I'll do the killing." The emissaries fell back and went into the den. Balcom was making some final adjustments when the great rock separating the passageway from the Graveyard of Genius swung slowly on its balanced hinges. Startled from his work, even though he had expected the thing, Balcom looked up, and in the passageway caught a glimpse of the dim outline of his arch-enemy, Locke. Balcom had been right. Locke had found the clue to the secret entrance to the tunnel. He worked feverishly to complete the final connection, but almost before he finished, Locke charged, and the battle was on. Up and down the passageway they fought. Although Locke was the younger man, yet in Balcom he found a giant of strength. It was a fight between these two alone, for no emissary, no automaton, now entered that passage of death. Neither uttered a sound. Neither had a weapon. It was the primitive struggle of man to man for life. But now Locke's youth and clean living began to tell in his favor, and he sensed that his adversary was weakening. he redoubled his efforts. After a particularly vicious blow from Locke, Balcom threw up his hands and toppled over backward, in the direction of the rack bar itself. Locke tried to throw Balcom's body out of the way. It was too late. With a thud, Balcom crashed full upon the plunger, driving it home. There was a blinding flash, a dull roar, and the earth rocked. Huge boulders were tossed about like feathers, and the roof of the passage caved in. Balcom was killed instantly. Locke, with better fortune, had been hurled to the ground, where the earth and rocks, in falling, had formed a sort of arch over his body. He was alive, though barely conscious. He knew that soon a search would be made for him. But, buried under tons of earth and rock, could any rescuers reach him in time? Was this the end? End of chapter 23. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 24 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 24. For a long time, Locke lay quite still. The shock to his nervous system had been terrific, and although physically almost uninjured, he had lost his usual grip on himself and felt very helpless. He felt terribly tired. The thought came to him that he had done enough, reached his limit of endurance. He craved sleep, a long sleep, and forgetfulness. But youth and the undying desire for life and accomplishment won over this deadly mood, and he began to take note of his position. His mind became clearer, and the ringing in his ears, caused by the explosion, gradually passed away. Then, like a flash, the question entered his mind of how he was able, buried under tons of debris, to breathe so freely. Why was the air not vitiated? He tried to move slowly and quietly so as not to dislodge any of the rocks that formed an arch over his body. He succeeded beyond his expectations, for his body was in a sort of natural pocket, and not one of his limbs was inextricably bound. Thus, twisting his body, he managed to draw himself into what seemed to be an even more open space. He hardly dared to breathe, so fearful was he that any moment he might reach a point where further progress would be impossible. He moved slowly, gropingly, then suddenly he recoiled in horror, for his hand had come in contact with something which he recognized to be a man's face. In his shaken condition, it was some seconds before he could control the wild jangling of his nerves. Then he searched his pockets, and finding a match, lighted it. There, covered to the armpits by dirt and rocks, was the body of Balcom, whose last act before his own death had been an attempt to murder Locke. Locke shuddered and redoubled his efforts to escape from the gruesome place. There still remained a small hole through which he must climb. But he negotiated it successfully, and in another moment he was above ground and free. Eva and Zita had followed Locke's instructions, but had not waited to find anyone to go with them to the exit from the den. Nor did they wait at the exit more than a few minutes. Eva had taken a small electric torch with her, and becoming impatient at the non-appearance of Locke, she flashed it about as she followed the lines and marks indicated on the plan of the den. She and Zita were surprised at the magnitude of the entrance passageway they uncovered. They had had to make a detour in order to reach the beach at a point where it was indicated that the exit of the den would be found, and even with the plan, which they consulted at every step, they almost missed their objective, for the cleft in the rocks slanted inward and was difficult to see even when one was standing directly in front of it. They had peered into the cavern and were waiting when they heard the explosion. They gazed at each other questioningly and with apprehension.
"What do you think it is?" asked Eva, questioningly.
Zita could, of course, offer no explanation, and did not try. Impulsively, both girls took a very foolish chance. Both had thought of Locke, and they started to run into the cave entrance and toward the sound of the explosion. Zita was in the lead, and it was at this moment that the panic-stricken emissaries came tumbling and fighting their way from the den. Zita shrieked to Eva to save herself, and Eva, although unwilling to leave her, knew that now she could do nothing to save Zita, and took her only chance of escape. As for Zita, the emissaries were too frightened to pay attention to her. But behind them came the iron monster, without nerves, it seemed. The automaton saw her and pinned her to the rock wall until she was unconscious. Then, picking her up as though she were a feather, it carried her out to the beach. Locke, the moment he freed himself from the hole which had so nearly been his grave, ran staggering toward the beach, for he felt instinctively that Eva and Zita were in danger. Eva and Locke must have started at about the same time, she in her flight away from the automaton, and Locke to find the den exit, for they met on the cliffside.
"Thank God you are safe!" exclaimed Eva.
Locke impulsively threw his arms about her and kissed her as they related their narrow escapes. Locke resolved to follow the trail of the automaton and to rescue Zita. Also, he had hopes of rescuing Eva's father at the same time. Eva wished to accompany him, but he would not think of it, and insisted that she return to Brent Rock and keep all the doors barricaded. In fact, he followed her almost to the house and saw that she entered safely, then hurried back to the beach. With the aid of Eva's electric torch, which she had given him, it was no difficult task to trace the huge footsteps of the automaton, though one by one the footprints of the emissaries took divergent directions, probably for the very purpose of confusing just such a pursuit. He followed the main track, however, until he came to the banks of a small stream, and there the trail was completely lost, for the monster had stepped into the water. Locke waded to the other bank and hunted for further tracks, but there were none to be found. The automaton had undoubtedly waded upstream to the point where he had decided to dispose of Zita. Nothing daunted, Locke started wading upstream. This stream ran in a gully between the rocks and the cliffs on either side, which were very high. Time and time again, Locke thought of turning back for more searchers. But he hated to return to Eva without at least some news, and therefore he persisted. He was at last rewarded, for just as he was about to turn to the right where the stream made a bend, he thought he heard a low laugh. He stopped dead in his tracks. Again the sound of the broken laughter came to him. Cautiously, Locke moved slowly forward until he could see around the bend. It was a strange sight that met his gaze. Under an enormous overhanging rock he saw about 15 men standing, while against the cliff he could distinguish the form of a girl. It was undoubtedly Zita. Sitting on a rock and quite close to her was Peter Brent. The emissaries were clustered around the central figure, which was waving its arms of steel and indicating what they should do. As the automaton gesticulated, tiny points of fire gleamed from its eyes. Seen in the light of the lanterns held by the emissaries, the automaton never looked more terrifying. Even Locke himself, who had encountered the monster so often, felt a cold chill as he watched him and his men. Locke turned noiselessly, for well he knew that alone he could do nothing. He started to retrace his steps to Brent Rock, and no sooner had he arrived there than he told Eva that her father still lived and was uninjured, and that Zita was safe in the new den of the automaton which he had discovered. Then he telephoned to his chief to send officers immediately to Brent Rock. After the explosion that had killed Balcom and had come so near to killing Locke, when he had finally rescued himself and had drawn himself out of the hole, there was one who watched him. It was none other than that mysterious being, Dr. Q. What twist of that disordered brain had brought him to the spot was not at once evident. However, as soon as Locke had left to go toward Eva, Dr. Q came from his hiding place, madly smiling and wagging his head. He peered into the hole, and seeing nothing, lighted a match and thrust it far down into the darkness. There was a sharp intake of his breath, for the match revealed to him the dead face of Herbert Balcom. Dr. Q drew back and stood erect. "Dead!" he muttered, as he ran his fingers through his hair dazedly. "Dead!" A strange thing happened. The mad light fled from the eyes of Dr. Q, and the twisted brain seemed to become clear. Suddenly, in the very field, the old man knelt down and prayed a thankful prayer for his recovery. What was the strange power which Balcom had wielded over him, which death had snapped? The officers arrived at Brent Rock, and Locke was ready. The party left immediately to go to the rescue of Brent and Zita, and it took them only a short time to reach the spot which Locke had located. Disposing some of his force below the hanging rock, Locke and some others went farther upstream. The two parties looked at their watches, waiting a certain time agreed on. Then the two parties moved toward each other. As they came in sight of the spot, Locke experienced a keen disappointment. He could see no one. Advancing farther, he discovered Brent still on the same rock. Guarding him were three emissaries. That was all. Zita, the automaton, and the other emissaries were gone. The three emissaries, seeing the numbers opposed to them, did not even offer to resist. They were placed under arrest, but nothing could induce them to tell where the others had gone. To fail Zita after she had so nobly saved his life in the lair of the hypnotist was an unwelcome thought to Locke, and he resolved to rescue her at any risk. But first he felt he must restore Brent to his daughter, and therefore the party returned to Brent Rock. Eva was beside herself with joy at the safe return of her father, and led him tenderly to his room and sent immediately for the doctor in order that he might not suffer from his exposure. While this was going on at Brent Rock, Paul Balcom was rifling his father's papers in the apartment where Balcom had lived. He had unceremoniously thrown letters and documents all over the floor in his mad search for something. Finally he found what he was looking for, and smiling triumphantly as he read the paper, he thrust it into his pocket and hurriedly left the place, not stopping even to pick up the papers scattered all about. Zita had evidently been watching the house, for no sooner had he left than she ran up the front steps of the Balcom apartment. In some way she had procured a key and let herself in. Then began a feverish search, very similar to that which Paul had instituted. Only this time Zita picked up all the papers, arranging them and placing them back in the drawers after scanning their contents. She had almost finished when a small book lying in a distant corner of the room caught her eye. At a glance she saw that it was a diary. Turning the pages rapidly, she finally came to one over which she fairly gloated, for its information, sold to the proper parties, might make her independent for life. Even as she was gloating over her find, there came the sound of many feet in the front hallway. Zita had no time to run out of the room before the door opened, giving entrance to 6 emissaries surrounding her. The emissaries locked all the doors and tramped out. Only their leader remained for a moment to throw a parting shot. "Remember," he threatened, "this house is watched. See that you act accordingly. You will if you know what's good for you." Then he slammed the door and locked it behind him. For a long time Zita sat there, too despairing to move. Then her ear caught the sound of stealthy footsteps in the hall, and she ran and hid behind the portières. The door opened slowly, and Paul stole again into the room. Having nothing to fear from him, Zita came from her hiding place and confronted him. Paul was startled for a moment at her sudden appearance, but recovered himself on seeing that it was Zita. The paper that he had stolen from his father's desk had proved to him that Zita had become highly desirable, and he was not one to miss such an opportunity. As he questioned her, Zita told him briefly her story, or rather such portions of it as she thought it desirable for him to know. Paul, in turn, assured her of his undying friendship and something more. His earnestness almost made it seem true, and he talked in his most fascinating and attractive manner. He finally ended his conversation with a direct proposal of marriage. But he had overstepped the mark, and Zita was not to be fooled.
"Paul," she laughed scornfully now, "you should be on the stage. It needed only this proposal to prove to me that I am really Peter Brent's daughter."
"Peter Brent's daughter!" he exclaimed. "No, not his daughter. The daughter of Dr. Q."
"Impossible!"
recoiled Zita, astounded at the assertion. "True, Zita," he asserted. "Absolutely true. Here, look at this paper." With hands that trembled, Zita took the paper and read an amazing table. Unless the paper lied, she was indeed the daughter of Dr. Q. There was only one thing to do, and that was to confront Dr. Q at once and force him to a full explanation. In order not to antagonize Paul, Zita was now particularly nice to him. Her object was to get him to consent to her escape, so that she could inform Locke and Eva of her discovery, and all three confront Dr. Q and wrest from him the story. At first, Paul would not let her go unless she consented to marry him, but Zita played him skillfully, so that finally he unlocked the door. Then Zita flew down the stairs and to a telephone around the corner, where she called up Locke, to whom she told as much as she dared over the wire. Locke told her that he and Eva would meet her within an hour in the lobby of one of the city's largest hotels, and Zita hastened there, where she waited impatiently until they arrived. Dr. Q admitted them immediately, and they noticed with astonishment the wonderful change for the better that had taken place in the man. For with the restoration of his mind, all the evil lines of his face had been obliterated, as it were, and in the place of the doddering half-imbecile they found a genial, kindly, and distinguished gentleman, who, with the utmost hospitality, brought chairs and begged them to be seated. Zita, in her anxiety to know the truth, could hardly contain her impatience. tossed from pillar to post, dominated once by the strong, evil mind of Balcom, Zita had run the gamut of human emotions before she had barely passed her girlhood. Seeing her agitation, Locke undertook to interrogate the doctor. "Dr. Q," he began, "I believe you know the perpetrator of the crimes to which we have all been subjected, and we have come to you in all friendliness to ask you to clear this mystery up for us. Balcom is dead," added Locke pointedly.
"Yes, I know that," interrupted Dr. Q.
"You know?" all asked. "How do you know?" The doctor told of having seen Balcom's body, but at first he could not explain why he was in the spot at the time. Then Locke went on to tell him of the document that Paul had shown to Zita. Dr. Q sank heavily into a chair.
"That document that Paul Balcom showed Zita," he exclaimed after a moment, "told the truth."
All were startled. Zita would have risen with a cry had not Locke gently touched her arm.
"Tell us the story," demanded Locke of Q. For some moments Dr. Q seemed to be collecting his scattered thoughts, as though still a haze hung over his mind. Then he began to speak, becoming more certain of his strange story.
"It was many years ago," he began, as all drew closer about him, listening breathlessly to his narrative. "And all these years I have been quite mad. The man now lying dead, Balcom, was the cause of all these years of misery."
The old man passed his hand over his head as though to wipe away a recollection of hate and fear, then resumed,
"I was an inventor in those days, and very successful. I had built up a great fortune, had built a great house, and in that house I had a beautiful wife and two of the loveliest children, a boy and a girl, that man ever had."
He paused again, then went on,
"One day a man entered my life and proposed to put my inventions on the market very advantageously. He was suave, polished, and apparently a gentleman. At any rate, I trusted him. You all knew him. It was Herbert Balcom. At the time I did not know that in order to give my inventions a clear field, the inventions of hundreds of poor inventors were to be suppressed. I know now, Miss Brent, that your own father was led along in the scheme, even as I was. Balcom possessed the master mind, and we were all as children in his hands."
Dr. Q stopped a moment. It was evident that he was speaking with restraint when it came to Peter Brent, perhaps glossing over what the man had done. Though he did not say so, the mere fact that at last Brent had seen the light and had planned a wholesale restitution weighed supremely in Dr. Q's mind.
"One day," he resumed, "Balcom came to me in what I know now was merely feigned excitement and fear. 'They're after us,' he cried. 'Brent and I have done our best, but the government is after you, and we can't protect you any longer.' Then, for the first time, Balcom told me of the real purposes of the company, told me that he had been drawn into it by Brent. It was all a tissue of lies, lies that drove me from my home and country. I hated your father with an undying hate, Miss Brent. Well, to make the sad story short, I took my wife and children and sailed secretly for the farthermost parts of the world. Off the coast of Madagascar, in the Straits, a typhoon came up. The vessel was driven on the rocks and wrecked. I was cast ashore, and I vaguely remember how, for days and weeks, I patrolled that beach, subsisting on shellfish, imploring God day and night to restore my wife and children to me. Then my mind gave way. The natives took me in, thinking me a god. They took me many miles inland. Savages the world over are superstitious about the demented, and so they treated me kindly. They installed me in a thatched hut of my own and made me a leader. How many months, years, I stayed with them, I do not know. But true to my mechanical instinct, I rigged up a forge and improved many of the crude instruments of the natives, principally those of agriculture. But transcending every other feeling, I hated Brent. In my madness, I conceived the idea that I would construct an iron giant, that upon its completion, if I could only procure the brain of a man who had died of a lightning stroke or other electric agency, I could, by installing this brain in the brain cavity of the giant, give it volition, make it a superman without feeling or conscience. It was a mad idea, but I was mad. At about this time, Balcom came to Madagascar. He found me, and knowing my intense hatred of Peter Brent, he cruelly added fuel to the fire. Already he must have known that Brent was coming to his senses and planning his great restitution to genius. He promised me that if I would come to New York with him, he would secure an electrocuted brain so that I could perfect my steel automaton and obtain my revenge. I was easily persuaded, and I sailed with Balcom, bringing the iron monster with me. A strange light gleamed in the old man's eyes as he spoke, not the light of madness, but of kindliness now. "Children," he said at length, "I have, during these lucid moments, watched you all closely. Call it instinct, if you will, but you, Zita, and you, Quentin, seem to be particularly dear to me now. Today, returning from the scene of the explosion, with every faculty not only clear, but rather sharpened by long disuse, I pieced the years, the months, even the days together. I searched in an old trunk, and I found this." It was a list of those rescued from the steamer Magnifique, and with amazement they read the names among the passengers. Quentin Locke, Zita Locke. There was a short note at the bottom of the list, to the effect that no trace of either the father or the mother of the two children had been found. Paper after paper which Dr. Q had found, where they had been preserved by Balcom, proved the identification and the story. Locke's head was in a whirl at the sudden change in relationships, but not more so than Zita's. Finally, Zita could stand the strain no longer. What had been a hopeless love was now explained.
"My brother!"
she sobbed, as she buried her head on Quentin's shoulder. Both turned to Dr. Q. Dr. Q no longer, but really Quentin Locke, Sr., whence had come the Q. His eyes filled with tears, and his voice choked.
"My children," he murmured, "I see that it is not too late for me to find happiness, after all. Our enemy is dead. It was Balcom, of course, who was in that frame of armor, who used that terrible poison that stole away Brent's mind. The iron monster will walk no more. Henceforth, Peter Brent and Miss Eva and you, Quentin, will—"
Dr. Q had not time to finish the sentence. The door burst inward. The automaton, its eyes aflame, stalked in among them. End of chapter 24. Recording by Roger Moline.
Chapter 25 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 25. As the automaton crashed its way into the room, all sprang back terrified, aghast. For this monster, they had felt sure, was now nothing but an inanimate shell of armor, since Balcom was dead. Yet here it was, stalking toward them and evidently as bent on destruction as ever. What did it mean? In an instant, Locke had helped Eva through an open window and turned to assist Zita. But Dr. Q forestalled him and had already taken her in his arms and had fled with her into another room. For the moment, Locke was surprised to see that the automaton totally ignored him. Instead, it stalked to the door and wrenched it open. There, cowering in the hall, in abject terror, was Deluxe Dora. How and why she had come there was a mystery. But the automaton did not hesitate. It raised its hands, and as it did so, long flashes of blue flame leaped from the steel fingertips toward the unfortunate woman. Once she shrieked, then crumpled and fell dead. The monster then turned its attention to Locke, striding toward him with a menacing gesture. But the diversion due to Dora had given all just the time they needed to make good their flight. Locke threw a chair to impede the progress of the monster, and then, as he saw that all the others were safe, he lightly vaulted out of the window himself to find them waiting for him in the little yard below.
"What do you make of it now, father?" asked Locke of Dr. Q. "Balcom is dead. Who is now in the Iron Man?"
Dr. Q shrugged. It was a mystery to him as much as ever, and he seemed unable to throw any light on it.
"But Deluxe Dora," queried Zita, "what had she come for? Why was she struck down first?"
Again Dr. Q shook his head. From the yard they could hear the automaton's heavy tread in the room, and as there was nothing to be gained by remaining, they left the yard and hurried away out of the neighborhood. They had not gone far, however, when Dr. Locke came to a full stop.
"I must go back," he exclaimed.
For a moment all thought he had again taken leave of his senses. Yet he was obdurate.
"Miss Brent, Eva," he explained, "you know that a grievous wrong has been done your father through me. He lies ill of that most terrible of diseases, the laughing madness. I alone possess the antidote, and it is in the laboratory that we have just left. I pray that that iron beast has not destroyed it."
At the mere words, Locke turned as if to go back for it.
"No, Quentin," remonstrated his father. "You must remain to guard Eva."
"Then I will go," insisted Zita. "I am not afraid now. Even when the monster carried me off, I overcame my fear, watched my chance, and escaped from his den where he had left me. I will go."
Finally, Dr. Locke agreed that Zita might return with him, remain outside, and give the alarm if anything happened to him. Thus, after many remonstrances, it was agreed, and Eva and Quentin went on to Brent Rock. No one had molested Brent in the meantime. The terror caused by the explosion, as well as the loss of Balcom, for the time at least, had evidently cowed the emissary band. While Eva made Brent comfortable, Locke went immediately to the laboratory, where he had something which he considered very important.
"Quentin," remarked Eva as she joined him, "your father spoke the truth, I believe, when he said that it was Balcom in the automaton. But if that was the case, who is in it now?"
Locke shook his head dubiously.
"I give it up," he replied. "It's too deep for me. But whoever it is, he won't trouble us long, I'll wager. I've been perfecting a special gun and an explosive gas bullet. No one can shoot the monster. Nothing seems to stop it. But this weapon, I think, will at last prove a match for it."
Eva, who had always had the deepest interest in Quentin's work, listened attentively as he explained in detail the working of the new weapon.
"And now we come to the actual loading of these asphyxiating poison bullets," concluded Quentin. "I really must ask you, Eva, to go into another room, for it is dangerous work, and you must not risk your life here."
"But, Quentin," remonstrated Eva, "we've risked our lives so often together that I have ceased to be afraid of anything."
Quentin was insistent, and finally Eva agreed. As Dr. Q and Zita neared the former's laboratory, they saw that all the lights in the house were out. Dr. Locke, against Zita's advice, insisted on going in and told his daughter to wait outside. It was then that Zita disobeyed her father for the first time, for she flatly refused to be left behind.
"No," she insisted. "I found a father tonight, and what we must risk, we risk together. It is no worse than the peril from which I once escaped."
There was no reasoning with Zita, and they let themselves into the little yard and went up the back steps. When they came to the door of the laboratory, they listened intently. There was no sound. Then they mustered up courage and cautiously entered the room. For a long time they stood quite still, not daring to move. Finally, Dr. Q suddenly lighted a match. The room was in terrible confusion, as though cyclone swept. Dr. Locke turned on an electric bulb, and the room was flooded with light. Everywhere there were traces of the automaton. But the monster itself had left the place. Dr. Locke crossed to the other door. There was a sight that made them shudder. The body of Deluxe Dora was still huddled in a heap on the floor. She was quite dead. But Dr. Locke had no time now to waste. Moments were precious. At any instant they might again be attacked. Feverishly he began to search for the bottle containing the antidote. At last he found it, carefully hidden, and in a bottle fortunately not broken. They left everything as it was and hurriedly left the place, on their way to Brent Rock. Meanwhile, in one of the worst quarters of the city, down in the cellar of a huge warehouse, a mob of emissaries were gathered. They were discussing the things that had led up to the explosion in the automaton's den, Balcom's death, and the arrest of their three pals. Plans for the future they discussed, but with their leader gone, these hardened men were still as helpless as children. Suddenly, above the din of voices, a strange, familiar sound was heard, a sound as of clanking chains, and the blood froze in the veins of every man present. Then, with wild shouts of terror, they scattered in every direction, for the automaton was stalking toward them. Balcom, the man who had given the Iron Man life, was dead, and yet the automaton was among them. That night, in the holds of many vessels and on the brake beams of many trains pulling away from the city, emissaries who once were slaves of the automaton were fleeing the city in every direction. When Zita and her father arrived at Brent Rock, Locke was still working at his new gas gun. Eva was in the library, but when she heard the voices in the hallway, she ran to welcome them.
"Oh, I'm so glad you've both returned safe," she cried. Then, unable to withstand the suspense longer, she asked, "Have you brought it, the antidote?"
When Dr. Locke told her that the bottle that contained it was safely stowed in his pocket, Eva sank, overwrought, into a chair and cried with simple relief and joy. In a moment, however, she had gained control of herself, dashed the tears from her eyes, and almost seized the bottle from Dr. Locke.
"Bring him down here, my dear," cautioned the doctor, still holding the bottle. "You would not know how to administer it."
Eva ran to her father's room, stopping only long enough to summon Quentin. Then together they led Brent downstairs. Brent's condition was still pitiable. His mind was a total blank. These people, Dr. Q, Zita, Quentin, even his own daughter, meant nothing to him. He lived and breathed, but no ray of light entered the poor brain. They guided his halting steps into the library as if he had been something less than a child, and placed him in the same big armchair in which he had sunk the fatal morning that the fumes from the candles had overcome him. Dr. Q drew out the bottle, and telling Zita to bring a glass of water, measured out a few drops of the antidote, pouring them into the glass. Then he moved over to Brent and tried to get him to drink it. For a long time, Brent merely clenched his teeth, but once he was induced to taste the mixture, he drank it eagerly. For ages, it seemed to those watching, Brent sat as before, vacantly gazing straight ahead of him, so long, in fact, that a terrible fear entered Eva's heart that perhaps, after all, the antidote would fail and that her father would remain without reason until the day of his death. Then, slowly, a change was noticeable in his eyes, and all leaned forward with overpowering intentness. What they were watching was like a miracle. Slowly, very slowly, they saw the soul creep back into those poor, mad eyes. Brent had been staring directly at his daughter as she watched him anxiously. Now a puzzled look came over his face, and raising a hand, he rubbed his forehead. Then a wonderful light seemed to shine from his eyes, and he held out his arms to Eva. With a sob of excited happiness, Eva rushed to embrace him. As Locke stood behind him, Zita and Dr. Q walked to the other end of the room, turning sidewise to the group. Suddenly, Brent turned his eyes away from Eva and noticed Dr. Q for the first time.
"Who is that?" he asked Eva.
"Why, Father, that is—"
At the sound of voices, Dr. Q had turned around.
"You!"
gasped Brent as he sank back into his chair. The look on his face was strange, perhaps half fear and half shame. Dr. Q came no nearer for a moment, while Eva hastened to explain what had happened. Then, unsteadily, Brent rose and walked over to the doctor.
"You are alive!" he exclaimed. "You have come again into my life so that at last I can make restitution. My daughter has explained to me all that you have suffered. Believe me, it was through my own weakness. It seems incredible that any man could be so infamous, so utterly without moral scruples, as was Balcom. I believe the villain implicitly. That is, and can be, my only excuse."
The doctor placed his hand on Brent's shoulder.
"I can understand only too well," he remarked, "for I, too, believed in Balcom. You were a reticent man, and so my dealings were all with him. I was gullible, an inventor, not a businessman. I should have come to you before I fled the country, I suppose.
Say no more about it, for I forgive you from the bottom of my heart." But Brent insisted on explaining that at least he had had a desire to right the great wrongs.
"I can remember it all now," he continued. "I was about to make restitution when a man connected with the company, I am sure now that he was an adventurer, a crook in the pay of Balcom, although Balcom probably tried to hide it, came to me. His name, as I remember it, was Flint. I was about to write a letter that showed that it was my intention to right a wrong, when something interrupted me, and the rest I can't remember."
Quentin, who had been standing behind the chair, now drew from his pocket a piece of paper which he handed to Brent.
"Yes, that is it,"
cried Brent excitedly, taking it and spreading it out before them.
"See?"
It was a note addressed to Quentin Locke, and read,
"I have done you a great wrong about which you know nothing, but for which I will make amends."
"It was broken off,"
exclaimed Brent, making a sad effort to recollect what had happened.
"I don't remember how. But this Flint had been telling me something about an iron monster. He had a model, said he had seen the real thing in Madagascar, that it had a human brain, that it walked and fought, that it had strength and life, but no conscience. He hinted that the thing would do me harm if I persisted in a course that I had determined for myself of giving back to inventors we had robbed the things of which we had robbed them. I did not believe him. I thought the thing absurd, and started to write the note, going a step farther than I had ever threatened Balcom."
Quentin, Dr. Q, and Zita exchanged glances as Eva's father resumed his narrative.
"Then I felt a choking sensation at my throat. I remember the effrontery of Flint's laughing at me, in a maudlin sort of way, and then a blank. The next I recall was just now, Eva gazing at me with a worried expression in her dear eyes. I called to her and kissed her, tried to comfort her. Then I saw you, Locke and Zita."
Peter Brent, from the time he and Flint had been overcome by the fumes from the candelabra until he received the antidote and recognized his daughter, had not known a thing. As they talked, there were many matters the two aged men discovered while they pieced together the happenings of years. Each had been duped by the same man. Each had suffered great trouble through this man's machinations and duplicity. As they talked, the attention of both turned to the younger Quentin Locke, who seemed overjoyed at the recovery of his former employer. Brent had a very great feeling of affection and respect for the younger man, for had he not really brought him up? As all questioned one another, they asked Brent much about the past, and he told them all. He told how he had become finally suspicious of Balcom, of how he insisted upon instituting a search for the doctor, his wife, and children. He told how Balcom had opposed him up to the last moment. Then he described his sailing half the world over in search of them, how at times he found a trail only to lose it again. Finally, he told how at last he had found that the mother had been lost, but the children saved.
"I was in Bombay," he continued, "in despair that I would ever find any of you. At that time I was an old man before my time, for my conscience gave me no rest. I went down to the quay to purchase a ticket for my return to New York, and, true to the habit I had formed, I asked the ticket-seller if he had ever heard anything of the survivors of the steamer Magnifique. "Do I know anything of it?" repeated the ticket-seller. "No,
but there's a man working on this dock now who never talks of anything else. He was a sailor on the ship, and one of the few who survived. You can believe me when I tell you that I ran down that dock and found the man. He remembered you all well, remembered you children when you were taken up with some other survivors, and he said he thought that some family had taken you to Hong Kong. I cancelled my passage to Liverpool and immediately sailed for China. Still, my troubles were not over, for it was weeks before I finally located you babies, Quentin and Zita. I won't burden you with the difficulties I encountered before the English family, the Danes, with whom I found you, would consent to give you up. Nor will I take time to tell of our return to New York through San Francisco. Let it suffice for you to know that we arrived safely after I had completely circled the world. I sent you to good schools, and when Zita was old enough, I made her my secretary so that I could watch over her. Quentin, being older, I had not dared to have around at first. I feared he might question me too closely. And what answer could I give him? Could I tell him that international patents had driven his father into exile, that I had been partly the cause, the indirect cause, it is true, but still the cause of his mother's death? I never found the courage to do that, and so I sent him to a preparatory school and later to college. Years wiped out his childhood recollections, and when he came here he came as a stranger employed in the company's laboratory. I make no defense, but I assure you all that my own sufferings have atoned for all the wrongs I have done. Brent broke down and was almost weeping when Quentin and Eva moved over to his side and reassured him. As soon as Brent had recovered from his weakness, he wanted to know all that had happened since he had been unconscious under the drug, and as he listened he was aghast at the automaton and Balcom's villainy. "I've something here that will stop him, though," added Quentin, as he showed the new gas gun he had invented and explained its deadly properties. "Bring him on again. I'm ready."
"Quentin, please don't joke about that terrible monster," shivered Eva. "It has injured us so often, I don't even want to talk about it, or about the government that asked you to come here and set things right. Let us forget, now that all is right."
Quentin smiled at her, and his quick mind saw that the time had come to guide the conversation into pleasanter channels. He moved close to Brent.
"It looks, Mr. Brent," he said quietly, "as though we all were at about the end of our troubles. But there are two of us here who are not quite happy, yet. Mr. Brent, I am going to claim a reward."
"Anything, my dear Locke, anything I have is yours."
"Then I may as well tell you that Eva and I love each other, and I want your consent to our marriage."
Brent beamed.
"That, Quentin, is the dearest wish my heart can have."
Quentin turned to Eva to take her in his arms, when there was a terrific crash of glass in the conservatory, the splintering of wood, and the automaton, arms swinging like flails, charged like a mad thing into the room. Its terrorizing eyes were agleam, its one desire, destruction. A large table stood in its way, and it demolished it as though it were matchwood. The interruption came so abruptly that Brent, who in his right mind had never seen the fiend and was now seeing it for the first time, was paralyzed with horror. He tried to rise from his chair, but in his weak condition fell back helpless. Quentin made a flying leap over the demolished table and placed himself directly in front of Brent and in the path of the monster. Dr. Q, Zita, and Eva started for Locke's side, but he waved them back frantically.
Locke reached into his pocket and drew out his gas pistol. The automaton was almost upon him when he raised his arm and fired. There was a blinding flash and a dull report. The automaton stopped in his tracks and, raising one mighty hand to its chest, staggered backward. Again Quentin fired, and the automaton slowly crumpled, sinking to one knee. There was no need to fire again, for suddenly the monster crashed to the floor and lay still. Locke started forward, but Eva shrieked for him to stand back. She had not forgotten that once she had thought the monster dead, and it had suddenly seized her and almost crushed out her life. There was, however, nothing to fear this time. Quentin reassured her that the gas fumes had passed away, then knelt by the iron terror. He tried to remove the steel headpiece, but before he could accomplish it, the doctor came forward and in a moment had unfastened the bolts. As they were doing so, a thick voice from inside could be distinguished, muttering words about the capture of Brent and Zita just before Balcom was killed, the escape of Zita, the rescue of Brent, the killing of Dora, who had evidently come to betray something in jealousy. It was all incoherent, and Dr. Q and Quentin hastened to uncask the man within. They lifted off the helmet, and there was the contorted and dying face of Paul Balcom, who had, in desperation, taken his father's place in a vain hope to secure the fortune for himself. The poison was too strong, and as the girls turned, sickened, away, the evil features froze, more evil than ever they had been in his evil life. A few days later, a brilliant wedding took place at Brent Rock, which itself was a present to the bride and groom. After the guests had thinned out, Quentin and Eva strolled into the garden, no longer in fear of attack from the steel automaton. Eva glanced at her ring, musing. "After all the things from which you have escaped, dear," she murmured a bit timidly, "I am afraid nothing in the world can hold you." Quentin drew her into his arms, while her hand rested on his shoulder, and kissed the little golden ring that encircled her finger. "Nothing but that band of love," he smiled. End of Chapter 25. Recording by Roger Moline. End of The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.